Welcome to Maine's Political Pulse. I'm Steve Missler, Maine Public's chief politics correspondent, alongside fellow politics correspondent Kevin Miller. The past year delivered a lot of big surprises, and Congressman Jared Golden's sudden decision to abandon his re-election bid was among them. Golden's withdrawal is part of a larger trend in Congress. More than 50 current members have announced that they won't seek re-election next year. That's more than 10% of Congress, according to NPR's retirement tracker. Some of these departures are age-related. Others are because members are running for governor. But neither of those factors are the case for the 43-year-old Golden. He has said hyperpartisanship, the threat of political violence, and the inability to get anything done in the current climate were all contributing factors. Kevin and I recently talked to him about all of that during a lengthy conversation that we're bringing to you now. Golden is somewhat reclusive for a politician. He doesn't do many interviews, and he has resisted the social media trend that others use to boost their profile. But he is confident. During our conversation, he spoke about the warring factions within the Democratic Party, how some Democrats refuse to recognize the electoral realities of the 2nd District that he represents, and yes, about that infamous column he wrote before the 2024 election that made so many Democrats angry. He also has a few things to say about why he drew a primary challenger this year from former Secretary of State Matt Dunlap. What you're about to hear is a lightly edited version of our discussion. Congressman, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Before we get into your decision, I wonder if you could just sort of take us back to when you were first elected in 2018. Congress was sharply divided then. The partisanship was pretty toxic. Neither the House nor the Senate were especially productive. And Donald Trump was president. But you still decided to run. So what's different about this current moment compared to when you were first elected?
Well, I was not incredibly surprised what Congress was like, having worked there as a staff of a senator. I kind of had eyes wide open. I think there's a fair amount of people that get to Congress and are rather surprised how dysfunctional it is, or really is. As bad as it was in 2018, 2019, when I first got there, it is worse today by far.
How so?
In almost every kind of metric I think I could choose. There are less members of Congress who see positive incentives to work across the aisle. More and more people who think that the way to kind of get attention or rise up is to just be kind of the loudest, you know, angriest, most partisan individual on your side of the aisle. I think that I would have said there was like 30 or 40 members of the House between the two parties when I first got there who were likely to be involved in efforts towards compromise and actually trying to do some good work or line up work that could get through the Senate with the 60 vote. It used to be that people would want to put together a good bill in the House and say, let's send something over that already, you know, has what it takes to get 60 votes. Now you'll hear people say, whoever's in the majority, let's just go for a really partisan bill. In fact, it'll even be better if the other party doesn't vote for it at all. Maybe that'll increase our leverage in the Senate, et cetera. So kind of ceding all the compromise over to that side of the Congress.
It sounds like almost like a perverse incentive to get anything done, right?
Correct.
You know what I mean? Like if the goal is to sort of score points or set up for, you know, a messaging vote for re-election or something like that. You're saying that's a lot worse now than it was when in 2019 when you were sworn in, I think.
Even among the members themselves, there is a growing kind of like ugliness to the whole business. Where I hear more people in my party expressing extreme skepticism and automatic negative assumptions about other members of Congress who are from the Republican Party, always, you know, kind of assuming the worst behind their actions without even having had a conversation, you know, kind of eye-rolling at the thought of attempting to work across the aisle. And, you know, that's true of just after January 6th, things were very bad. Somehow just keeps getting worse and worse.
Yeah. So. It sounds like you're saying this is a problem on both sides, right? This isn't just a Republican issue or a Democratic issue. The partisan gridlock has gotten worse on both sides.
Absolutely, yeah.
Is it leadership? Where is that coming from?
I think it's coming from all around. I think it's members themselves. I think it's the way that leadership, you know, tends to play the game. You can look at what happened to Kevin McCarthy in the last Congress. Just increasingly, we see people being taken out of leadership positions and punished in the House of Representatives for ever working across the aisle. Even now, as Speaker Mike Johnson's trying to reconcile the differences within his own caucus on health care and the ACA subsidies, he's got the Freedom Caucus openly threatening, if he makes any deal with the Democrats to pass something on health care, that they'll get 12 people to sign a petition to begin a motion to vacate the chair, which would be an effort to remove him from being Speaker. Mm-hmm. So that was not a normal thing that long ago. Now it's just kind of a standard threat in their caucus anyway. They set the rules up that way themselves, but it's kind of a sign of the times. I think, too, it's fair to say social media, the conversation taking place amongst the entire population also creates incentives, perverse incentives, and also, it's just, in some ways, the body reflects the body politic.
In your op-ed, where you announced that you wouldn't seek another term, you talked about the increasing incivility in politics, often embodied by leaders on both sides. You said the Republican Party has been, quote, hijacked, first by the Tea Party, but then by the MAGA extremists. But you also suggest that the Democratic Party is increasingly allowing extremists to run things. Obviously, you think that those things have gotten worse during your 7 years. Do you see things changing? I guess the question is, how do we get out of that? This mode that we're in right now.
I don't know that I have an answer for you there, Kevin. You just need more people who go and do the job with a different set of, goals, I guess. I want to govern, legislate, actually work on issues, get them through into law, which generally means that you have to be willing to work with other people. Increasingly, it seems like a lot of people thrive and find some kind of fulfillment just in getting a lot of likes on social media, a lot of attention on their Instagram posts. I see a lot of young members now who they almost look like they're auditioning to take your job. They walk around with like little staff with them with like little backpacks with like weird camera arms hanging out of them and stuff, and like they're all geared up, and it's like a mobile studio for putting out content. And they'll like come off the floor on a vote that is no surprise to anyone. Everyone knew what the outcome was going to be. They'll like step out in front of the Capitol and it might be like raining, and they're like, I had to brave the storm to come right out and tell you what just took place on the House floor. It's rather fake. But I think absent any other way to put your energy, towards something positive, that people just, they accept what they feel like they can get credit for. So that's not a very hopeful response. But, I had a little tiff with Indivisible here in the state of Maine after I spoke at a event for Cobee College students. And, I was trying to differentiate between a local kind of Indivisible group where I think probably the volunteers there mean what they say and are fearful about the Trump administration, want to do their part as they see best to give voice to the fears of many people in the country, or concerns, frustrations. But when you look at their national leadership and their own founding documents, they literally say, like, they spell it right out, we want to be the Tea Party of the left, which makes their goals different than the goals of the locals. You know, at the local level, they're saying we want to stand up to the Trump administration. Well, at the national level, they're basically saying we want to primary Democrats and beat them until they look like the type of Democrat we want. Those goals actually sometimes are in sharp contrast and actually will stand in the way of successfully standing up to the Trump administration. Indivisible is launching primaries against incumbent Democrats across the country, not trying to figure out how to win a House majority and take it back from the House of, you know, from the Republican Party. So I could go on and on about why I don't think things are likely to get, you know, much better anytime soon. But I feel like everyone's searching for rock bottom, so conceivably it exists.
And also, this is Steve talking. I guess the logical question is, like, you know, you mentioned how the national indivisible groups were, they were looking to primary sitting Democrats. Do you feel like that was the issue in drafting Matt Dunlap to run against you?
I have no reason to believe they were in communication, but yeah, could care less one way or the other.
Why do you think you drew a primary challenger? What was going on there? You know what I mean? Do you have any insight into what happened? Why Matt Dunlap is, you know, who's, he's not a progressive Democrat, at least in my...
Well, he certainly says he is now.
Does he say that?
Yeah. Hey, he's free to be whatever he wants to be today.
Yeah.
No matter what he was in the past, so...
Why do you think that he decided to run against you? I mean, my impression when you were in the legislature, when he was the Secretary of State, is that you guys had a pretty decent relationship. I don't know if you know how friendly that was, or... But it at least seemed like you guys didn't have animosity towards one another. Like, what happened?
It's a great question. You should ask Matt Dunlap. I haven't talked to him. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's I think that tells you an awful lot, right? One would have expected a phone call or something along those lines.
He didn't even say, "Hey, look, you know, here's why."
I think if you listen to some of his interviews, he'll talk about the SAVE Act. Mm-hmm.
The voting act, right?
Yeah, yeah. I would point out in. Of course, he himself was Secretary of State, so he knows this, but the SAVE Act basically reflects the common practice here in the state of Maine. If you are a first-time registrant to vote, you're going to have to, in some way or another, prove who you are, what your residency is, and you're going to have to show some ID. Mm-hmm. I can also tell you from my own internal polling throughout this year that requiring identification to register to vote has like over 70% support in this state, mm-hmm. as it does across much of the rest of the country. I think for whatever reason, Matt found himself a good widget there to justify his getting in and making another run for CD2. And, you know, he's tried to run... for higher office before and come up short in primaries back in 12. Cynthia Dill won that primary. Mm-hmm. I think he's thrown his name out, expressed interest in the past, and it should be no surprise that he still has that interest. So
yeah.
I don't begrudge him that.
Gotcha. I'll just ask this straight up. Would you have gotten out of the race if you had no primary challenger?
Yes, absolutely.
Really?
I didn't know that until I knew it. Mm-hmm. No matter what anyone thinks, I'm not like spent much time looking in the rearview mirror at Matt. I don't mean to be offensive, but I've had very good polling through the years. I've never seen my polls off by more than a point and a half. Mm-hmm. And I leave this primary field with a commanding about 30-plus point lead over Matt Dunlap. Mm-hmm. If I wanted to win that primary, I would.
Right.
Over any contender that I see in the field or I'm hearing would be in the field. I was fine. But at the end of the day, as I went through the process I went through, and mostly from mid-September on, I made a decision for myself and my family, and also one I think that's good for the people of Maine. And at the end of the day, if you're not feeling like you can give the job 100, 110%, then why not make room for someone else who's going to bring that type of energy. I did this for 7 years here. It'll be 8 by the time I'm done, plus 4 in the state house. It's a good long period of service.
Yeah. I mean, regardless of whether or not you thought you would win, and it sounds like you do, or you would, that you even had to deal with that obstacle, was that an issue at all?
The actual campaign itself, not something that, you know, I would have worried too much about. Mm-hmm. We know what to do. People know who I am at this point. And it just would have been what it, you know, what it would be. I would say that one thing that's changed over the last couple of years is there is a third of the kind of Democratic, let's say, primary voting population that is increasingly displeased with me and the way that I go about representing the whole district, that whole district I put special emphasis on. They are always thinking that the reality that's right there in front of them is somehow not true. Mm-hmm. They've just become more and more militant. If you ask them, they will tell you that Democrats don't like me anymore. Mm-hmm. And yet 2/3 of the primary voting population are pleased with the job that I've done. They understand my pragmatism. They understand the need to actually win Republican votes in order to win and represent the district. There are 32,000 more registered Republicans than Democrats, and this 1/3 increasingly just, you know, doesn't want to believe any of that. Mm-hmm. And they think there's a bunch of magical, invisible Democrats out there to turn out, and that you can, and in fact, that it would be better to win without relying on Republican support. Mm-hmm. It's just not. That's not going to happen. But like that third is, they're very personal and negative about what they have to say about other Democrats, such as myself, in the decisions and governing decisions that we make.
Yeah.
They basically say that I aid and abet fascists and fascism, that I am helping to dismantle American democracy. And sometimes they're the most threatening and negative and, frankly, vile themselves, which they say they hate about MAGA and Donald Trump.
Right.
So, yes. You know, some part of me says to them, go look in the mirror and see the example you set for today's youth.
So this is Kevin. That seems like a good segue into one thing we definitely want to ask you about, which is your op-ed saying that President Trump is going to win and that you were okay with it. That, to outside observers, seems like kind of a pivotal moment in your relationship with some of the Democrats here in the state, and maybe the National Democrats as well.
Oh, but on the contrary, nationally, I'm more popular than I have ever been. National Democrats like that I win. They like that I am holding the reddest seat of any Democrat in the entire country, to include the United States Senate. I think they see in me and my team something to be replicated in order to win majorities and actually hold them.
Were you surprised at the way it landed with the Democrats here in Maine? I mean, you accused Democrats of pearl clutching, and you talked about Democrats using scare tactics and suggesting that Donald Trump was a threat to democracy. So kind of were you surprised at the reaction here in Maine to that among Democrats?
I would point out that I was right. Donald Trump won the election. He also won the national popular vote. And I think that it was fair to point out that a party that was running on an election message that we, the party, would save democracy from Donald Trump, whom was deemed a threat to democracy, was totally failing to resonate with enough people to win the election, right? So over half of the voting population didn't agree that the man was a threat to democracy. Or does that kind of third of Dems that I'm talking about actually believe that half the country knowingly voted for someone who would destroy democracy? You know, there's all kinds of people that will tell me right now with certainty in their eyes and voice that President Trump must be plummeting in CD2. On election day, when he won the district by 9.5 points, his favorability among voters was about 48%. When I last polled the district in October, he was up to about 52% favorability.
Really?
That means he is more popular today in CD2 among all likely voters than he was on election day. I just don't believe that 52% of people that have a favorable view of him actually believe that he's taking away their freedom or destroying their democracy. And I'm not looking at him, I'm looking at them. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to see through their eyes and see what they see and figure out what it is that they want. But, you know, in my op-ed, I simply said, if Joe Biden chooses to run, he's going to lose to Donald Trump. And I didn't say I would be okay with that. I said American democracy would be okay. Right? And I still believe that. Why? Because I don't think the American people are going to put up with a dictatorship.
I guess
I'm most concerned about the corruption.
Mm-hmm. Corruption in the Trump administration?
Absolutely. Just lining their pockets in so many ways. Even in, you know, you can call it soft corruption, whatever you want, but they are finding any way they can to bring profits either into the president's family or just into his circle in general. Mm-hmm. I hate that, right? But, you know, corruption is a political problem no matter who's in the White House, and something that should always be taken seriously. There's no doubt that I think this administration is doing well at it, unfortunately.
I want to talk a little bit more about, like, your assessment of the Trump administration in a bit, but I don't want to leave the op-ed just because I want to ask just a basic question about it. What were you trying to achieve by writing that?
If you looked at the campaign, you would have seen that I basically was just the same guy that I always am. Honestly, after the Biden debate, there wasn't a day that I went anywhere that I didn't have a member of the press trying to force me to make some kind of statement about whether or not Joe Biden should be the nominee, mm-hmm. if he should run for re-election. I could see that conversation would continue forever until I answered the question, and that even if Joe Biden decided to step down, that the press would just be all over me to, you know, say, well, now who or now what? So frankly, it was just a response to the press to say, you know, I'm not going to do 100 different interviews and talk about this 100 different ways. Here you go. It's Joe Biden's decision whether or not to run for re-election, but I think if he chooses to run, he's going to lose. But I also was kind of suggesting, not to the press, because you guys aren't here to take political advice from me, but to my own party, like, listen, in this moment, you've still got a chance to pivot to a message about the economy, about affordability, about how we will govern the country, you know, more effectively than we did when we had, you know, full control, but more effectively than Kevin McCarthy and the Republicans were. Like, let's talk about the things that win elections, and instead the party continued to make it about the threat to democracy, and we lost. Mm-hmm. And I am okay with that because I support democracy. When 50%+ of people vote for someone, then, you know, that's who won the election, and you got to move on.
There are still a sizable number of Democrats out there who think that Donald Trump is trying to destroy democracy. Some of the things that we've seen in the past 10 months, you know, the ICE agents, the masked ICE agents without identification, swooping up people off the street, including, you know, U.S. citizens, him suggesting that members of Congress should be executed for treason because they're, as you correctly pointed out, they are pointing out that members of the military are obligated to disobey an illegal order. Do you have any concerns that he might be making changes that would be damaging to our democracy?
I have faith in the American people and in the institutions that we have. And I think in the face of someone whom will do almost anything that they can get away with, if they think it's in their best interest, because the president is, you know, very focused on what's best for him, above even what's best for the country. If you give him an inch, I think he'll take a mile. Our job is not to give the inch, to make sure that the institution and the checks and balances are being put into play with full force. But I think that we'll be just fine on the other end of it.
You think those checks and balances are being applied in full force right now?
I think the courts are very active on an almost daily basis. We're going to win some. We're going to lose some. I think that finally we're starting to see a little bit of a spine in the Congress in the last month or so. I think that the president's agenda gets tougher moving forward.
This is Steve. You alluded to your concerns about corruption and, you know, self-enrichment. Is that the thing that bothers you the most about the presidency, this administration?
Look, in the final analysis, I think defying the courts, refusing to implement the laws that Congress has made is a big deal. Mm-hmm. But I've tried to point out to people that defending the institutions means allowing them to go through, you know, the full thorough process. So when there's a court, ruling, and then the DOJ is in appeal, I'm not going to, run out and say, you see, this is evidence right here that democracy is coming to an end. Mm-hmm. They're going to play that process right through to the Supreme Court. When they start openly defying the Supreme Court, that's a much bigger and more concerning thing.
This is Kevin. You've been very critical of the left wing of the Democratic Party, and have seemed to suggest at times that you feel like that kind of far left wing is driving a lot of the decisions that are being made, or at least what's coming out of Washington. Where do you see the party being in 5-10 years?
I have no clue, Kevin. Mm-hmm. You know, I think if you just start with gerrymandering and the fact that there's really only 20 to 30 truly competitive House seats in the general election, then you will be on the trail to seeing that one of the strongest points of leverage in the Congress on both sides of the aisle is the fear of primaries. Most members that are there, unlike myself, in those kind of 20 to 30 of us that are in these very competitive seats, live in greatest fear of being primaried.
And that's true. I mean, that's certainly the perception, but from someone who's a member of Congress, that actually is true, that one of the greatest fears of a member of Congress is being primaried.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm kind of shocked I even have to, reconfirm that. People are living in fear of those primaries. The reality of the Democratic Party today, not at all dissimilar from the Republican Party, is it's more like a coalition. We are like maybe 4, possibly 5 factions, some of whom are almost irreconcilable with the others at this point. And that's true in the Republican Party. They're probably, 2 to 3 different strong factions there. I've been trying to say to the party for the last year, accept the fact that we are this group of factions, that we are not one party. Stop warring with each other for full control of the party and its future, and just learn how to govern together. And then maybe we would be focused enough such that we could win elections together as well. But if we continue down that road, I don't think one is anywhere near strong enough to dominate, over the others. Certainly some are stronger or weaker, but I don't see anyone who's got an electorate within that coalition itself that is going to lead to like future dominance. So I think this kind of, infighting and battling with each other continues unless everyone decides to work together. Mm. And that's just within the Democratic, that's to say nothing about trying to govern with other parties.
And I almost hesitate to ask this, but it has been brought up in the past. Do you still consider yourself a Democrat? Because there are some suggestions that maybe you would change to be an independent at some point. You're still a Democrat.
Well, if I were going to do that, I would have done it, right? How does that, what I was saying, tie back to the gerrymandering and the fear of primaries? Well, I think it's fair to say that the more progressive, you know, far left element of that coalition is more dominant in social media among certain type of, let's say, elite culture, you know, setting entities in democratic politics. And so, like, they do have a little more momentum there. But they're not able to, like, seal the deal because they're not as competitive in the general election, where there's a wholly different electorate that you have to deal with. And that, you know, kind of is a countervailing force. Like, they're very powerful in that primary, you know, kind of setting in not all but most, I think, kind of regions right now. But I don't know what the future will look like because, like, eventually people do have an expectation of winning and winning majorities and then setting the agenda for the country. So they're going to have a pressure to deliver here if they have a very successful primary season.
I want to just circle back real quick to Kevin talking about, you know, your critiques of the Democratic Party, both parties really, but, you know, just the direction that they seem to be going. What does that mean for somebody like you? I mean, do you have any ambitions to come back to public service? Would you like to be governor someday? That's a thing that, as you know, having been in the state legislature, you can actually get something done in that position. And that seems to be a problem, or it seems to be a problem you've identified in getting out of Congress, is that it's just difficult to produce meaningful results for your constituents. That would not be as much of a problem if you were to be governor or, you know, had ambitions to do that.
Yeah. It is, you know, important to me that when I am doing something that I feel like there are prospects to, you know, go hard for what I believe is right. And often I feel like the party, because of how broken Congress is, tries to just kind of tinker around the edges of what is, you know, wrong with our economy, with the way that, you know, the government is set up and structured, you know, kind of put like little band-aids on things when really I think we need some smashing and some, you know, kind of aggressive change and to try some new things. And when I think about the state of Maine, I think that there's a real need for someone to be governor and for a legislature who would be willing to, you know, really go big on trying some different things, mm-hmm. Not sticking with the kind of status quo of the last, let's say, 40 years, like not to, you know, pick on the Mills administration or the LePage administration. I'm just saying broadly, mm-hmm. I think that we need to really flip the table here, reset the pieces and try some big new things. And in talking with you know, some friends over the last couple of years about you know, how aggressive might I be if I were governor, you kind of like realize that the status quo is pretty happy with itself in many ways, and it's easy to get into the legislature and look at those different factions and the tensions existing within in them and just kind of, you know, crack and frack, and next thing you know, you're fighting with your own majorities. Elements of the other party have no incentive to work with you because they're going to surely try and beat you in just a couple of election cycles. So it's questionable, you know, just how much you can get done, mm-hmm. unless you just want to tinker,
right.
Which I'm not interested in doing. But to answer your question, yeah. More forcefully, I guess, just or more clearly, I still have a lot of passion for politics and care about the state and about the country. And I am not at all planning on running for anything again in the future. But, you know, some of my mentors through the years have said, you know, don't take things off the table.
Yeah.
Because you just don't know. There's no masterful plan for the next, you know, 5, 10, 20 years in my life other than, you know, getting a good hard focus on the family.
You mentioned your family, and I want to talk about another piece of your rationale for getting out of the race, and that's political violence, threats to your family. I mean, I was stunned to read that detail about, you know, spending Thanksgiving in a hotel room somewhere because of a threat to your home. I mean, I can't imagine what that's like. And, you know, and I'm sorry that you had to go through that. A situation like that is, you know, it's just unfathomable to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I don't have a good sense of how often you've been threatened. And so we don't have a window into that. And so that's why I'm asking that question, is just like, how bad is it? And how much of that played into your decision not to run again?
There's a story told about a World War II vet in Band of Brothers, mm-hmm. where he says he's on the plane, you know, going to jump into Normandy, and someone says, half of you aren't going to make it back from this mission. And he jokingly said to the guy sitting to his left and right, well, it's been nice knowing you two suckers, which is kind of human nature, right? Mm-hmm. The assumption that those things aren't going to happen to me in my own right. But I think that it's become very clear to lawmakers around the country in both parties that there is a growing and very real threat. It's pretty hard to ignore in the last year, where we've seen even state lawmakers being assassinated because of national politics. Two attempts on the president in the last campaign cycle. Shooting of Charlie Kirk on live feed, mm-hmm. for all the nation to see. Like, I think it's getting harder for people to go on with that kind of, you know, good-natured, naive assumption that it won't be you. Mm-hmm. I haven't wanted the press to over-focus on this in regards to myself. I obviously was willing to die for the country in Afghanistan and in Iraq as a young man. I have done this job for 7 years, despite the threats, which have existed since the beginning. But, you know, the kind of frequency, the kind of tenor of them has grown, the national reach of them as I've become more of a known figure. I think what's important to remember is that just the responsibilities have changed. I now have, you know, two young girls with my wife, Isabel, and, you know, some of the, you know, threats are made against them, not against me. And, you know, that'll hit home. I don't think I overreact. I'm not very dramatic. And yet, you know, I've taken the threats seriously enough through the years that I've kind of escalated my own security circle from, you know, starting to carry, for self-protection to, getting bigger guns, mm-hmm. You know, more effective ones, to taking security measures around the house, in my operations, even event like at Kobe College, or where people are like having town halls, where it's just like, you know, are folks really thinking about the security, you know, questions that are going around in the minds of lawmakers in this day and age, and not just thinking about themselves, but the safety of the community around them. Mm-hmm. These are really serious threats, and unfortunately, like, the security measures and being taken are necessary. Mm-hmm. And I think people should just think long and hard about that. Because it is also a threat to our democracy, perhaps more than any one individual in elected office could ever be. This mindset that we are warring with one another over politics is perhaps most concerning to me.
Yeah.
In the future of the country, and thinking about the future that's out there for my daughters and other people's kids.
Kevin, you have something, buddy?
I really appreciate your candor on that topic, and we're obviously going to have more time to talk to you, because you have another year left.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to ask you to recap all your accomplishments over the past 7 years, but I do want to touch on one that just happened recently. You pulled off kind of almost the rarest of rare accomplishments in the House, the discharge petition.
Yeah.
And this is basically, you were able to do an end run around House Speaker Mike Johnson. You were able to get Democrats and Republicans on board to take an initial step towards reinstating collective bargaining for mm-hmm. federal workers. How, I guess, how big of a deal was that in your eyes to be able to accomplish that?
It was a rare success, and it was done in an extremely rare way. I see in that, like, the kind of, you know, years of work and establishing credibility across the aisle. You know, I've gotten to a place now that if there are people in the Congress who are working on some kind of compromise, House Republicans will want to see me in the room, or perhaps question whether or not this is really a deal in the making, if that makes sense, because they know that once I've kind of shaken hands with them on something, like, I'm going to stick to it, and I'm not afraid, and I'll try and create space for that, to actually get done and become law. Things aren't finished just because you pass it out of the House. So Brian Fitzpatrick and I aren't done on that, and we're going to take our work to the Senate in the new year. And that's, you know, whether it's fighting for the collective bargaining rights of federal employees, or, trying to restore them, or the ACA subsidies.
Which you're also working with Brian Fitzpatrick on, Republican from Pennsylvania.
Correct. And he and I, of course, he signed Hakeem Jeffries just the other day, and that one's going to get a vote. But we, perhaps more quietly started a discharge on a Fitzpatrick Golden bill, which is almost identical to the deal that is being talked about by those kind of 20 senators who are being reported on as working on some type of deal. I think it's fair to say that a three-year extension is not getting through the United States Senate. So, I think Brian and I will be working hard on that in the Senate as soon as we get back to Congress in January as well. But it felt good to know that the relationships I built can, lead me to a place where I can get some big things done in a very unusual way, kind of historic way. And some of the unions have been, very appreciative, but I've let them know I'm not happy until they get their rights back.
On that same point, do you feel like now that you're no longer running for re-election, you're kind of out of that picture, does that give you even more leverage potentially to working with Republicans? Are they going to come to you even more often because now they don't have to worry about giving you a win that you might be able to use against them in the election?
Well, I certainly got nothing to lose, and I'm going to go for broke on all my priorities in the next year, which are, they're priorities for Maine and for the people I represent. A lot of them are the same issues I've been working on for years and not quite, getting it done or coming close or getting, kind of partial wins. But I'd like to, get a little bit more done here in the year ahead. So nothing to lose. Just going to do what I think is right. Should be fun.
I do have one quick question just about, maybe two. One is, I know that when you were first elected, campaign finance reform was a huge deal to you.
Massive.
Is it impossible to get anything done on that front? Or is this, you talk about being able to go for broke now.
Yeah.
There's a real sense, I think, out there that, that something's got to change in our campaign finance system.
Yeah. The public gets it. Mm-hmm. And I think they're kind of in on the joke too, because not only do they get that it's corrosive to our politics and just the way that it's practiced, but I hear so many people say how does all these billions of dollars get spent and create such, crappy ads that don't even speak to me at all? Mm-hmm. How can you spend, $100 million trying to convince me that someone sucks and you've basically left me feeling cynical about, you, mm-hmm. And almost rallying around, the person who's getting clubbed. Mm-hmm. It is a massive, kind of diminishing return on investment being made in political advertisement and spending. And yet the data will also show you that if you don't contest the space, it will do damage to you. Mm-hmm. Like, as long as you're just kind of like meeting it as close to, you know, within even force, then it's rather ineffective at changing the outcomes. Mm-hmm. But if you're, you know, massively outspent, then it can really hurt you. So members of Congress spend tons of time raising money.
Yeah.
And it's a terrible waste of time. No one seems happy about it. I don't know who the big beneficiaries are, but except those with the greatest means to give have mm-hmm. the strongest, you know, influence over the system as a whole. Mm-hmm. You know, but in that way, like, yeah, sorry, but like the billionaire class is able to use all these loopholes to spend limitless amounts of unaccountable money.
Right.
And it is, I think it's disgusting. And I think it's a massive piece of everything that's going wrong with the political discussion in this country. I like what some countries do. I think it's like France. They have very short campaigns by law, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you can't start advertising until a certain date, just a few months before Election Day. And then 30 days before Election Day, they do a market blackout.
Yeah.
I just don't know why it takes this much, but some of the old timers don't realize just how much has changed in the last 15 years. Mm-hmm. I had one member of Congress, nice guy, said, "Oh, I had a really expensive race this last cycle." This was in 2023. I said, "Well, how much got spent?" He said, "Like $4 million." You know, my last one here was $48 million.
Right.
Which is ridiculous.
And that's not even a full accounting, because some of this money is spent in ways that can't even be really tracked. You know what I mean? Like, that's...
Correct.
That may be an underestimate.
Yeah. I mean, I could tell you one thing I didn't sign up for and didn't realize, maybe I was a little naive to it, is just how powerful television and advertisement is. And I didn't know I was going to become, you know, like a household name, where I'm now sitting around over 90% name and face ID around the state, mm-hmm. like statewide. I didn't see that coming.
Yeah.
And I don't particularly love it. I've been willing to, you know, kind of live in it, to do the work. But I hope, you know, people understand that that was never something I really wanted.
Yeah.
And I'm not feeling bad for myself, but it just never really occurred to me that that was going to happen.
Yeah.
And who knew? Because it wasn't long ago that CD2 races were $2-3 million of total spending. Mike Michaud's races were kind of in that category, and it's quickly just exploded in the face of Citizens United and everything that's followed in the last, 15 years.
15 years, yeah.
It's out of control.
Yeah.
I don't know how to rein it in. Other than that, I think people should boycott it.
Yeah.
Like, stop paying attention to the dumb ads.
Yeah.
We always tried to have ours be as positive as we could. I would, you know, fight against, you know, some of the softer, maybe, you know, hits we would put on my opponents. But I always wanted to say, like, let's spend like 9 out of every $10 talking about what we've got to offer.
Mm-hmm.
And at least I can say to my own party, like, that's what you ought to be doing. Like, stop being defined as the party in opposition to someone else, and instead focus on telling the people of Maine and the people of the country what your positive agenda for the future is.
But
at least then you're going to be spending the money on something that might make people feel hopeful.
I know that you've already said you're not going to endorse Matt Dunlap in the race. So is there anybody that you would recommend that does run?
I've had a lot of conversations with people who are thinking about running for office.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of times people think that, like, the party apparatus is just all powerful and will just, like, come in, and if they decide that you're the good, you know, candidate that can win, that, like, they're just going to, like, dump this kind of like infrastructure in place, and you're just going to have a magical, you know, kind of campaign operation with tons of money.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not how it works.
Right.
And actually that's good. And so, you know, I've been telling anyone that asks, kind of like, look, I'll tell you what I will tell all the others. It's going to be hard work, and that hard work will grow your political muscle such that you might be more competitive in the general election against Paula Page. I don't think I would have beaten Bruce Poliquin in 2018 if I hadn't had a competitive primary field to contest with. And so it made me better. And I guess I would say that.
And you didn't have establishment backing in that primary either, as we've discussed.
No, but you know, like the House doesn't do that as much as like maybe you sometimes catch wind of in the Senate. But even then, I don't think, you know, it's all knowing and decisive. I mean, for Christ's sakes, like I don't even know what the DNC does. I don't know if I've even spoken to anyone who's associated with the DNC in 12 years of elected office. But I'm not throwing out names. I think the people that decide to put their name out there have to come to that, you know, for their own reasons. And, you know, I guess what I am telling my colleagues in Washington is that I think it's important that we win a Democratic majority in the next election in the House of Representatives. I'm a little more skeptical that the Senate map is favorable, but, you know, at least divided rule and a little bit of power and leverage in Democratic hands would be good for the country. So I'm just going to give them really hard-nosed advice about where to spend their resources. And that's going to be a combination of the instincts that I've developed through the years, you know, my kind of finger on the pulse in the CD2 community, which has come through 43 years of life. And, you know, knowing what data to actually look at and how to actually read it. So I've always told folks, if you do everything the party tells you and the polls say that you're going to lose, they'll cut bait and let you drown on your own in a heartbeat. And you can be the biggest pain in their butt. But if the polls say that you can win, they'll get behind you in the final push, right? But everything that comes before that, you got to earn it yourself.
Got it. Well, thanks for taking the time and giving us so much of it. And like I said, this won't be the last conversation. But I'm glad that you carved out a little bit especially before the holiday too. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
And that's Maine's Political Pulse for this week. I'm Steve Missler, alongside Kevin Miller. A reminder that The Pulse is available wherever you get your podcasts. We also publish a newsletter. Subscribe at mainepublic.org/pulse. Our music is by Rob Holt. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you again soon on Maine's Political Pulse.